This is the download of Sport and the British from the BBC. You can find the terms and conditions on our website at bbc.co.uk/radio4. Sport and the British is presented by Claire Balding.
Football exploded from an amateur game into the biggest business in sport. Play became work. And it all began in a Lancashire mill town.
Sport and the British. The dawn of professional football. Set.
This ground, Deepdale, this is where professional football all began. This is where it started. And who would have known then, who could ever know, that it would be so big, become worth so much? Preston was the club at the forefront of a change in football that began in the 1880s and 90s, the commercialisation of the watching and playing of football. But why did it happen here? Professor Matthew Taylor of De Montfort University.
Lancashire is really the heartland, the centre of the Industrial Revolution. Tens of thousands of people migrate to the textile factories of Lancashire to work. Gradually, over time, developments such as the 1847 Ten Hours Act and other legislation leads to a shortening of the working week. This provides a space, particularly the development of the Saturday half day, which allows a particular time slot in which football can really develop.
If you came here for one of the big derby games against Burnley, let's say, you'd climb to your seat at the back of the stand here as one of over 24,000 people, because that's the capacity these days at Deepdale. It was because of them that clubs fenced off their grounds and started to charge an entrance fee. It was because of them that they built great big new stadiums to improve the spectacle. But at that stage, no one saw football as a money-making enterprise. Businessmen would back their club, but really only for local prestige, for bragging rights, not as an investment opportunity. But the crowds kept growing, and in particular here in the northwest. So where the cup final in 1882 at the Oval in London got 6,000 people, more than three times that many had watched Darwin play Blackburn a few months earlier. And that strength of support was definitely worth reporting.
The enormous crowd was an imposing sight. They were closely packed all round the enclosure. The trees, and even the shrubs too, were taken advantage of by hundreds of juveniles, perched in mid-air like so many crows overlooking the field.
Not everyone relished the prospect of large crowds. One London reporter called Big Gates the curse of the game. Another said it challenged the very essence of the sport, which should be played for the honour of victory alone, without any ulterior thought as to how much the gate is worth. So, of course, what spectators wanted was to see their team win. And in the 1880s and 90s, Preston were the biggest winners of them all. As the players leave the dressing rooms here at Preston, they'd be aware, walking through the tunnel past the photographs of former greats, of what a special club this is. And it is steeped in history. It's the place that Tom Finney, who became Sir Tom Finney, spent his whole career. And his face adorns the grandstand away to my right. But going way back, this is the club. Historically, this is the place. They have a record that will never be beaten. They were known as the Invincibles because in the very first season of 1888 to 89, Preston were unbeaten in the league and the FA Cup. They were football's first double winners, and they won the league without losing a game and the cup without conceding a goal. And their success was down to the vision of one man, William Suttle, a local mill manager. He can be credited as the father of professional football, the man who took it from a recreational sport for the elite, who had leisure time, to a sport that could provide a living for the working man and could be enjoyed as mass entertainment by everyone. Professor Tony Mason.
Sutton was a great innovator, not just off the field, but on it as well. He was one of the first managers to seriously search for players far and wide, especially in Scotland, which by the 1880s had already developed a certain football sophistication, particularly in the Glasgow area. By 1884, Preston had 11 Scots on their books. One of these Scots players was Nick Ross. He was known as the Demon Back because he had green teeth which he hissed through as he ran with the ball.
There is a reason why the National Football Museum was founded here, and it's all to do with William Suttle and how he transformed Deepdale into a theatre for sport. Ian Rigby is the archivist here at Preston.
This is the same site that Preston North End came to in 1875. It's the oldest professional site still going. It was just a farm. There was nothing around it, probably just a rope. And in 1882, they'd started making a bit of money at the gates, and they built a small stand down this side where we are now. And they used to get changed in that corner on your left, and they used to call it the dressing tent, even though it was a cabin. And every year, when they made money, they improved it. If you look at it today, hopefully it'll be premiership class. Looking at it now and talking about it, it gives you shivers down your back. Yeah.
But the game was still amateur. William Suttle was a man who saw that that had to change. But it was Suttle's business acumen and preparation of the team that were vital to success. As a manager of a mill, his view of football was different from the gentlemen amateurs who ran the game. He championed professionalism and likened football to a science. In one 1887 interview, he stated,
"I consider football is played more scientifically than ever it was. Professionalism must improve football, because men who devote their entire attention to the game are more likely to become good players than the amateur who is worried by business cares. No purely amateur clubs will ever be able to hold their own against a professional team."
When William Suttle walked into the centre of the home dressing room to address his players, he did so as the man in charge. He was the forerunner of the great paternalist managers of the late 20th century, Matt Busby, Bill Shankly, Brian Clough, Alex Ferguson. His team was his family. And where other clubs were managed by committee, William Suttle was in sole charge of Preston's training, their tactics and team selection. Professor Matthew Taylor again.
William Suttle was really the first great football tactician. He was one of the first managers to use a blackboard to explain his tactics. He used chess pieces arranged on a billiard table to explain to his players what he wanted them to do. His organisation even went as far as arranging for a cobbler to be brought with the team on away trips so that the footwear of the players could be altered as the underfoot conditions changed. He was really identified with the team. Preston was Suttle's team.
Suttle broke the rules in terms of paying his players, and he challenged the spirit of the game by importing from outside the local area, helping talented footballers find work in local industry or as publicans. In 1884, he admitted to paying his players, and Preston were expelled from that year's FA Cup. Tension mounted, and as would happen in rugby, a split was imminent. 36 clubs from the North and the Midlands threatened to break away. But in football, moderation and compromise won the day. In July 1885, the FA agreed to legalise professionalism, provided that it would be contained and controlled, as in cricket. Professor Tony Collins.
The decision to legalise professionalism by the Football Association had reverberations far beyond football. In rugby, the Rugby Football Union realised that professionalism meant that the traditional middle-class clubs that had dominated football, such as the Old Etonians and the Royal Engineers, were being eclipsed by professional working-class teams. This was something they did not want to happen in rugby. So in 1886, just a year after the decision to legalise professionalism in football, the Rugby Union banned any form of professionalism and made rugby union a formally amateur game, something that would last for the next century.
In 1888, the first football league was founded and it had its headquarters here at Preston. It meant that for the first time there was structure and organisation. Weekly home and away fixtures gave clubs a guaranteed income by pulling in the crowds, and it gave them the thrill of rivalry. Here's Professor Tony Mason again.
You could watch competitive games between clubs. You could watch games that mattered, games that had something on them. You know, there was a cup tie, you went to the next round, you got to the final, you won the cup. It was this kind of structure that encouraged the growth of football, and certainly encouraged the growth of football in Preston.
And the other important thing about your local football club is that it's your umbilical cord for life. You are forever connected back to the place that you came from, to the club that you supported as a child. And that's because football gets into the bones of local culture. And it always did. At a popular level, it did what Victorians and Edwardians were doing at civic level. Gave a sense of pride and belonging to a place where people lived. But what happened to William Suttle? The man who'd taken this club, Preston North End, to double victory. Once untouchable, adored by his players, he'd lost the support of some of them. And the club had financial problems. It went bankrupt in 1893. The pressures of running his mill and the club were too much for him. In 1895, he was arrested on the street for embezzling funds from the mill and transferring them to the club.
It was a great local scandal. And yet the papers, because I think Suttle had become one of them, you know, the middle-class owners and the middle-class writers of the newspapers felt he was one of them. They were all part of the same social class, the people who ran Preston. They reported it. They couldn't fail to do that, but more in sorrow than in anger. So he does come to a sticky end.
Suttle was sent to prison for 3 years. He emigrated to South Africa, and he died there in 1911. His story shows the pressures of football's move towards commercialism. By the turn of the century, the game was recognised as business, pure and simple. Clubs had become limited liability companies with directors and shareholders. In 1905, just 20 years after professionalism had been allowed, Alf Common became the first footballer to be sold for £1,000. Money in football is here to stay, as are players and managers who have no local or even national connection with their team. And yet the fans still come, they still pay, and for the moment they show no signs of desertion. But when there are moans from the stands and in the press that it's no longer a sport but a business, the truth is that football has no one to blame but itself.
Thank you for downloading Sport and the British from the BBC.